tell me where in the world is
crime in San Diego?
Welcome back to another episode of Where in the World is Crime in San Diego? I'm feeling a little better this week.
I think we're feeling a lot better this week.
Yeah. I still have that congestion, that noise of my voice. I feel it, but it's like this whole nasal infection. Oh my gosh.
Hopefully we sound a lot better too. Thank you guys for well wishes. We have been struggling this week, but we are finally feeling slightly like ourselves again.
Yeah, like I actually went back to work and it was a little rough, but I feel pretty good. Anyways, I hope you guys had a chance to listen to our previous episode of Sanely Insane. That was pretty amazing. So Chula Vista has its own rap sheet of murders. It's crazy.
Let us know what you guys think. We also have a Facebook page for you guys to post your thoughts, but DMs work just as well. We love hearing your guys' insights on what you think, what your, you know, point of views are. We get a lot of opinions that we missed, and I will be posting those on Facebook. I just didn't get a chance this week, but yeah, like that was insane. And this week is going to be no different.
Yeah, this case has been on my radar for a while, and I had no idea of how much of a rabbit hole we went down with this one. There's so much into it that we could literally spend hours talking to you guys about every single little detail, but we're just going to cram in the major pinpoints of this case that we're going to talk about. And oh my gosh, even at the end, I thought I had it figured out, but no, I'm still left with so many answers.
And by the way, going through a Google Forms, this case was requested as one of the most. I think we just didn't realize how big of a case it was going to be. And then Adrian picked it and I was like, wait, this sounds familiar. And I was like, oh my God, people have been asking for this. So I'm glad we finally got around to it.
So who exactly are we going to talk about? Well, we're going to talk about the McStay family and Charles Chase Merritt. Then this trial just recently, right before the pandemic, came to a full circle, and it was amazing. Like it was just crazy. So we're going to start getting into it. But this week's episode is called Ping Point.
So sources for this week are SanDiegoUnionTribune.com, NBCNews.com, CBS8.com, SBSun.com, CNN.com, and Two Shallow Graves, a docuseries that is on Investigation Discovery Plus. So if you go down this rabbit hole, I highly recommend you check that out because it gives you a lot of info we won't be able to add in. Disclaimers for this week are murder, child murder, and bludgeoning.
All right, so let's roll right into it. Let's start by introducing Joseph McStay. Joseph McStay and his family, Summer, his wife, and two children, Gianni and Joseph Jr., they lived out in Fallbrook, you know, not too far from Oceanside. And, you know, Joseph was a businessman, and what he specialized in was these water feature fountains that you would see like in hotel lobbies or at the front desk of a restaurant. And he was like really
doctor's office.
Yeah, like those little water features where it's the water that runs up. And it just it flows down like a slide, and it just gives, you know, like a logo or whatever. That's what he would specialize in. And he had his business partner, Charles Chase Merritt, who was the welder that would help design and create all these masterpieces for their business. You know, but let's fast forward to February 6, 2010. Let's introduce to you Patrick McStay, who is Joseph's dad. He gets a phone call from a strange name he's never even heard of before. Dan Kavanaugh. And he just lets it go to voicemail and he ignores it. He doesn't think about it. Now, Patrick lives in Texas, and, you know, Joseph and his family are here in California in Fallbrook. So he doesn't really think about it. And he usually hears from his son periodically. And by this time, you know, it's been a couple of days since he's talked to his son. And, you know, the family is kind of adventurous. They like to go for hikes and camping. So it's nothing out of the normal or unusual for them to kind of go off the grid for a couple of days. Kavanaugh continues to call Patrick. And at this moment, Patrick answers it. And Patrick learns that Kavanaugh is Joseph's business partner for the website that he oversees, and they work together. And, you know, Kavanaugh is telling Patrick, like, hey, like, I'm trying to get a hold of Joseph. He hasn't answered my phone's calls for a couple days. I'm trying to get paid. Can you help me out? And he notifies his son, Michael, who lives in the area, to go check on Joseph. But Michael says, I'm too busy. I don't have time for that. And Patrick gets upset. So a couple more days go by.
This is over the course of the weekend. So, like, it makes sense. I mean, you don't really want to drop what you're doing.
Yeah. So all this started on the 6th, and now it's the 10th, which is the Monday. And what happens now, Angie?
So it is learned that on February 9th of 2010, Chase Merritt is trying to get a hold of Joseph McStay, and he does a drive by the house, but nothing really comes of it. February 13th, he contacts his brother Michael, and him and Michael go to the home to search for the family. At this point, it has been 9 days since anybody made contact with the McStay family. And 2 days later, on February 15th, Michael finally calls the police to report them as missing. This has been 11 days since their last contact. He kind of just says that, like, he didn't want to report too fast if they had taken, like, a last-minute vacation or if they had gone out of town to visit family and just not told anybody. He was trying to not overreact to the situation. Once they reported them, though, San Diego Sheriff's Department treats it as a voluntary missing persons case. So it's not considered a crime. The reason is because they don't know if they got up and just had plans and didn't notify somebody. Like, it's one of those really tricky situations.
Yeah, like they might have gone for like a little vacation trip or something where they're just out of town.
Yeah, you don't always tell everybody what you're doing. But within days, Joseph's mom decides to clean the house with bleach. And Michael takes Joseph's computer and takes it to his home. And from there, it's never seen again. So they kind of cleaned out the whole house. They say in case it got, like, foreclosed on, that it was ready to go, which is kind of odd reaction. Because if you're thinking somebody's going to come back home, why would you go to those lengths to clean?
Well, yeah, because also in the moment, too, like, it was reported that they were kind of doing, like, renovations. So I don't think the family was actually going to sell the house anytime soon. But having the mom show up and actually clean the house, and
the mom also claims that she was cleaning to keep busy, which I could understand. If your child's missing, you're freaking out, you want to do something to help, you know, you're thinking maybe if they come home to a clean house, like,
yeah, but she didn't realize by cleaning the house that she was potentially getting rid of, you know, pivotal evidence inside the house,
because at the time it wasn't considered a crime. But yes, I totally agree with
you, you know, like, it's like you just leave things alone, like, it's not your house, just leave it alone.
They did more harm than good in that sense.
Yeah.
The report was filed for the potential missing persons. The San Diego Sheriff's Department learns that the McStay family vehicle was found in San Ysidro, which is literally right at the border before you cross into Mexico. And it had been towed on February 8th from, like, a parking citation. And they found potential footage of them crossing into Mexico. But it's really hard to tell because it's the back of their bodies walking into Mexico. So it honestly could be any family with the same type.
Yeah, like I forgot to mention earlier that their kids are young. They're 4 and 3 years old at the time. And it's really strange because when you get into Mexico, there's so many cameras that take photos and pictures and videos of you that I find it strange that they cannot pinpoint exactly if it is or if it's not them or any family, like, crossing into Mexico. It's just very strange, you know. But their car was there. It's towed away, you know, while this whole missing person investigation is going on. But, you know, this is where things kind of just die off, really, honestly, for a number of years. 3 years go by. 3 years and 9 months, to be exact, go by. before we learn exactly where and what happened to the McState family. Let's take you up north, 100 miles from Fallbrook, to Victorville, California, in San Bernardino County. There was a person on a ATV reported that they found two shallow graves. They found essentially a skull. And investigators went out there, they dug up the graves, and the bodies were decomposing so badly that they couldn't really, you know, identify who it is. So they had to go use dental records. And through the dental records, they were able to find out that there were positive matches for Summer and Joseph McStay. But also with those two graves were two infant bodies, which happened to be their sons. It was November 13th, 2013, when their bodies were found. And, you know, there's so many questions at this moment. Like, who are the potential suspects? Who could have committed this crime? How did the family get up? There's just so many things to lay out, you know. So through the investigation, there's initial suspects.
So with suspects, obviously look at the people closest to the family. So they look at Michael McStay, Joseph's brother, first. He might have been jealous. He was hesitant to report them missing in the first place. He was too busy to go check on them, even though Patrick stressed that he was very serious and he was very concerned. He took over the business as soon as he realized that Joseph was missing. Him and his mom cleaned out the house. It just, a lot of things that didn't really seem like a concerned sibling. Another suspect was Daniel Cavanaugh, the first one to report them missing. How convenient that he was the first one to notice that they were missing early on. He was looking for money. As soon as Joseph was gone missing, he also helped to navigate the business. And he helped himself to $200,000 in Joseph's absence that went directly to his bank account from the business. Next on the list was Chase Merritt, the welder and business partner as well. They learned that Chase had been forging checks from the account. He had access to the QuickBooks to also grab money. He had also been looking for Joseph very shortly after. And one of the things that they noticed was that somebody that drove by the house that was caught on camera drove a white truck. And both Michael and Chase drove white trucks, utility trucks, which were pretty common at that time, but it still definitely put them in that line of suspicion. Next, we had Michael McFadden, who was Joseph's oldest son from his previous marriage, stepdad. And Summer had suspected that the child that they were sharing between homes was experiencing some abuse from that other home, from the McFadden household. So she had filed a police report early 2010, late 2009, and she stated her name. It wasn't an anonymous report. And Michael McFadden had sent threatening emails saying that he would come over and shut her up himself. And that definitely raised a lot of red flags for people as far as violence. Lastly on that suspect list was Vic Johansson, who was Summer's ex-boyfriend that was still in love with her. And earlier that year for her birthday, he had sent her an email telling her that he still loved her and that he always would. So they obviously had their work cut out for them with multiple people that could have potentially and had motive to hurt the McStay family.
So there's so many like questions and so many suspects. But one thing that happened is since the graves were in San Bernardino County, all of the evidence and all of the interviews and information that was taken before in the San Diego County was transferred over to San Bernardino. So they essentially started from the beginning. So they redid their whole investigation. You know, everybody was brought back up to, you know, to interviews and this whole big, you know, case got brought back, and you know, they try to not leave any stone unturned. Let us fast forward to November of 2014. And by this point, investigators in San Bernardino have had a full year
of, you know, reports, and they arrest Chase Merritt, and they arrest him with the murders of Joseph McStay, Summer McStay, Gianni, and Joseph Jr. McStay. But, you know, all this evidence that was, you know, collected is, what's the word I'm looking for, Angie? You said it before. It's called, what is it called?
Circumstantial evidence.
Circumstantial evidence, where literally meaning that there is no smoking gun. There is no real, like, this is how you did it. This, you know, so now we get to the fun part of the trial, which it's just hunker down, buckle up, because it's going to twist your guys' mind. Angie, where should we start? I don't know where to start.
I mean, the beginning.
Okay, so let's start with the beginning then. Okay, so it takes a number of years for this trial to start. It took, what, almost five years. So let's fast forward to the start of the trial in January 7th, 2019. That is the initial start of the trial.
Pre-COVID.
Pre-COVID, yeah. Right before COVID and everything, but oh my gosh. Here we go. The date is February 1st, 2010. Now, Joseph had an online banking account, and for some strange reason, there were certain amounts of checks that were created and then deleted. But those checks were created and deleted by Chase Merritt himself. Now, it's not known if maybe these were, you know, forged checks or either, you know, duplicates or something about it, but
Well, let's clarify that Chase Merritt was added as a vendor by Chase Merritt. So he was paying himself out, like if he was a vendor to the business, even though he was technically a business partner.
But yeah, but if it's like one of those things where, like, hey, he probably was trying to pocket money under the books, and this is where Joseph caught wind of it. So on February 4th, 3 days later, Joseph calls Chase to go meet at a Chick-fil-A up here
in Rancho Cucamonga.
Right in the valley. And what's talked about at the actual meeting is not disclosed.
According to Chase, Joseph let him know that he trusts him with the business, and he gave him a bunch of blank checks so that he could distribute and kind of like show him responsibility with the money part of it. Unfortunately, Joseph's not here to corroborate that, but his family says that that's very unlike him, that he liked to keep control of the finances of his business and that he didn't trust anybody to handle that aspect of it.
I wouldn't either. You know, if it's like, you work for me, I pay you, you don't pay yourself, you know?
Yeah.
And
especially if you caught somebody doing something shady, I don't see you rewarding them by giving them more responsibility.
Yeah. Now, through the trial, it's known that Chase has a little bit of a gambling problem. And this just kind of puts more light onto him that, you know what, like maybe he was taking money and either, you know, maybe Joseph was being a nice guy and giving him cash up front. And maybe he was trying to get it back, or either, you know, he caught wind that, okay, Joseph caught wind that Chase was taking more than what he should have. And I think initially that's what happened, that Joseph caught him and said, hey, you know what? You're taking too much money. Like, I know you're in a tight spot, but this is not acceptable.
Well, working with Joseph was his only source of income, and it came to light that he had gambled $15,000 in casino withdrawals. And that's his only job. Like, he wasn't exactly making decent, but he wasn't making that kind of money. And during the QuickBooks investigation, they found a single balance sheet, and it kind of looked like it was money that Joseph was marking that he was advancing to Chase. So maybe he was helping him out for his family or for his kids. Like, maybe he was giving him extra money, but I don't think he was trying to give him too much. And I think Chase wanted more. So yeah. He began forging checks to take more.
Yeah. So sticking on the 4th, it isn't in the afternoon when they have that meeting. Now, later that day is the last time that anybody ever sees or hears of Joseph ever being around. It's approximately 8:28 p.m. on the 4th of February, where Joseph calls Chase Merritt. But then it's known that the call doesn't register. So I'm assuming that the call, like, either Joseph calls Chase and is immediately hangs up. So, like, it registers on Joseph's phone, but the call never got received on Chase's line.
Yeah, almost like a butt dial or, yeah, like...
So, where is Chase? At this moment, Chase is kind of off-grid. It is approximately from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. that same day, where Chase's girlfriend, who is a mother to his children, is trying to get a hold of Chase, but he's off grid. They don't know where he's at. Like, where could he possibly have been? This is one of the key points in the trial for the McStay's murder.
So let's keep in mind that this trial lasted 6 very long, treacherous months.
Did it last longer than the OJ case? I didn't look into that, but oh my gosh.
I didn't compare them either. But this was a very dramatic, long trial.
Yeah.
Not to mention it was highly publicized, which made it that much harder. I don't know how the jurors stuck it out, but shout out to them. So we broke down all the evidence, and this is just small, brief descriptions of them. Obviously, if you want to see the in-depth, definitely watch the documentary. But we're going to start with the neighbor had cameras. And in February 2010, she happened to catch footage of someone coming up the street and in front of the McStay house. And from what a forensic analyst testifies is that it appears to be a 2000 Chevy truck, like a utility truck. Which, if you guys remember, Chase Merritt drives a white utility truck, and so did Michael McStay. Apparently, they were very popular in the 2010 time.
They're everywhere. They're good working trucks, and
I think my dad had one.
Yeah.
So the only hiccup with this is that the prosecutors had initially hired a different forensic analyst, and after some time, that analyst decided that he couldn't testify that with certainty. That matched a truck, let alone a Chevy utility truck. So he was fired or he quit. That's kind of hazy. And there were text messages to prove this conversation, but the prosecutor that had those text messages deleted them because he needed memory on his phone. And remember, the trial happened years later. So he didn't think to hold on to them because to him, they weren't important at the time. The defense comes back saying that that's illegal and that's destroying of evidence. It becomes a big old debacle. I can see both sides. So that one kind of leaves you in a little bit of question mark.
Yeah, it's like, were they purposely trying to hide this information? And this is the first of many in this case.
Yeah, but I don't even know where my phone is from 2010. So I can't really blame somebody for like upgrading a phone. And I don't know if there was a cloud back then.
Yeah, anyways.
So the next one was, we're going to go back to that phone call that we had been talking about a little bit ago, the 8:28 phone call. So on the stand, Chase's ex-girlfriend at this point testifies that she remembers seeing the phone ring, even though it never registered on the phone records. And she says that Chase and her had a huge argument about how he didn't want to answer at the moment. He said he'd answer tomorrow. And she was telling him to stop putting things off, and it became a whole argument. And she specifically remembers because of this. Chase's daughter also comes on the stand to say that she remembers her parents having this discussion. But if you guys remember, she had been calling him multiple times from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. And she testifies that he was home. She just didn't know where in the home he was. And they lived in an apartment complex. So her justification is that he was on the property, but just not in the house. And prosecutors asked why she didn't just go look for him around the property instead of calling him 6 to 7 times, if she was concerned for his safety since he wasn't answering. And to this, she doesn't really have an answer. She just says, like, eventually he made it back in, so it didn't matter. But 6 phone calls is a lot.
Yeah, and also being gone for like 3 to 4 hours.
And over that span of time.
Something's fishy, I feel like.
His daughter also goes on the stand to testify that she remembers her dad being home that evening. She doesn't remember what he was doing or where he was, but she knows he was home. Shortly after she testifies, the prosecution plays some audio clips from his jail visits. And also, keep in mind, there's a documentary being filmed at this time, which I think it hurt more than it helped.
No, it really did. Honestly, like, I feel like the documentary series, like, it goes into so much detail of like the behind the scenes, but at the same time, it really kind of paints the light to where it I feel like it persuades you or it moves you to where it makes you believe or feel that, you know what, Chase Merritt is the
like actual, it's all set up.
It's all set up.
Well, yeah. There's clips from his visits with or phone calls with his daughters and his ex-wife, and he's saying how, you know, he's coaching them on what to say on the stand. And don't, you know, if that's what you need to testify to, then that's what you need to say on the stand, which technically you're not supposed to be talking about your testimonies on phone calls in the first place. But it definitely sounds like he's coaching them on what they remember and what they should remember.
Yeah. Like, I mean,
it does not help.
You should always, like, those phone call conversations, they're always recorded. You know, and it's like there is no real safe way to speak unless if it's like behind closed doors. And I don't know why Chase.
Not even then, because there's an instance where he tries to yell things through the glass so she could like read lips. But because there's a documentary, there's video footage.
Mm-hmm.
And because they were trying to communicate without words, that allowed the jail to put mics into the booth. So that even if they weren't using the phones to communicate, you could still pick up what they were saying.
Yeah.
Just to make sure that it all stayed above board and legal. And that was able to be used in court as well, which he was saying things that he should not have been saying. Like,
yeah.
There is no privacy in jail, guys. In case anybody's wondering, in case you ever go to jail, don't say anything you're not supposed to.
Especially if you're up for murder.
Yeah. Especially in a murder case with the death penalty on the table.
No. It's crazy. So, leading on to the next piece of evidence.
So next they found Chase's prints in the family vehicle that was found abandoned on the borderline.
On February, was it the 8th, right?
Yeah. February 8th, yes. February 8th of 2010.
Yeah.
So there were traces of his fingerprints in the driver's side and on the center console and on the door. They weren't on the passenger side where Summers were found. They were found overlapping Joseph's, which to the state meant that he was one of the last people to drive the car if the prints were still there. And prosecutors claim that it was there because he was the last person to drive the car when he drove it down to Mexico to abandon it at the border. The defense comes back saying that since they last met on February 4th at Chick-fil-A, that it's most likely that Joseph shook his hand at the end of the lunch or meeting they had. And then he got in his car, he opened the door, he touched his steering wheel, touched your center console, and the traces that he got from, like, Chase's sweaty hand would have left a fingerprint in his car.
Yeah. But the defense was also saying that the swabs that were taken, the tests, the samples, they weren't labeled correctly. That they
were all mixed. So it was all steering wheel, center console, and it was then
all
door.
One. It was all one swab. So they were like,
they weren't one. They were put into pieces, but they weren't individually like, this is steering wheel, this is one knob, mm-hmm. this is one knob.
They were improperly
center labeled. Console was one together. Yeah.
So that's where the defense was also like, oh, okay. But still, like, I mean, and they interviewed Chase is like, have you ever been in that car before? It's like, oh yeah, like once or twice when we went paintballing like months ago or this and that. And I feel like...
And he claims he was only a passenger in the car.
Yeah.
And then later during court, he recounts and says that he moved the car once as a favor from like one parking spot to another. And it was within recent dates. And that's how he can explain himself being in the driver's seat of the car. But again, this didn't come out until he was in the hot seat in trial. When they asked him during the early investigations, he swore he had never been in the driver's seat.
Mm-hmm. And that's where he changes his story.
Yes.
And it's like, ooh, you shot yourself in the foot with that one, bud.
They also mention the forged checks. And the prosecution, again, is stating this as motive. He's stealing money. He was trying to cover his tracks. He was trying to take over the business, getting Joseph out of the way. He could have kept it to himself. Defense comes back saying that Joseph gave him authority. And the proof is that he gave him those stack of checks at the Chick-fil-A on February 4th, which the only person that can corroborate that is Chase. So the state also learns that Chase called QuickBooks, the online banking system that they were using, and he impersonates Joseph McStay, and he requests to get the account canceled and deleted, which according to employees, there's a very uncommon request, especially if you're thinking of like taxes and like record tracking. Like, why would you ever want to just delete your entire business accounts? Like, you would want to keep them for reference. And he called from his cell phone, but stated that he was Joseph McStay. The prosecution is saying that he was doing this, again, to cover his tracks and get rid of evidence that he was taking money. But the defense and Chase claim that the reason he did it is because Joseph wasn't feeling too well during this time. And anytime that they had to call QuickBooks, it was like staying on hold for customer service was like an hour long thing. So he offered to do it as a favor. But it was a request from Joseph to do it.
I don't believe that.
Again, the only person to corroborate that is no longer here. So,
I mean, for me as a business owner, I wouldn't want to put my business needs or like future in someone else's hands other than myself. So I don't believe merit at all.
There are family members that say that Joseph hadn't been feeling too well. He had been going to the doctors. He had like some mysterious illness going on. They couldn't quite pinpoint what it was, but he hadn't been feeling well in his last days. But I don't know if he would be the person he would turn to handle this. I feel like Joseph would have had someone else maybe, or maybe ask Summer to do it. Like, I don't know. Just seems like their business relationship wasn't as strong.
No, I agree. Yeah, it's just really strange that you would probably have Chase take care of it, but I don't believe it.
Prosecutors believe that if Joseph was at the point where he was about to fire Chase for discovering all the shady activity, that Chase reacted and, you know, wanted to like save himself basically and silence him. So that's where obviously the motive ties in.
Well, like the motives that I see for Chase is, you know, financial gain, obviously. And, you know, he probably didn't want to be that, like, lose his job, but it's like, this guy got caught. You know, he got caught forging checks. He got caught stealing money. And it's like, you know, Joseph, to me, it kind of seems like he was being the good boss and being a good guy and a good friend to him, you know, because Chase was his moneymaker. He was making all these designs and he was making them hundreds and thousands of dollars. And, you know, I mean, dude, come on. But let's pick it up into court. And what is the next piece of evidence that we have? Well, we have the graves. We have the gravesite. So at the gravesite, there was the evidence of the potential weapon used for the murders. Now, the family was bludgeoned to death with a 3-pound sledgehammer. Now, here is really strange because you would figure that the prosecuting team would, you know, do CODIS on CODIS, CODIS. Oh, everything has to be on CODIS, you know, and traces of DNA. But
so for those that don't know what CODIS is, it's the DNA system that is nationally connected. And this basically has solved many crimes recently. It's one of the newest technologies that came out.
Yes, CODIS is a national database of, you know, everyone's potential DNA that is in the criminal records. So the prosecuting team did not run everything through CODIS. I don't know why. Maybe they had a reason why, but that's one of those questions that we will never know. But the way that the bodies were found at the gravesite, like, Joseph's body had a cord wrapped and the body was also wrapped like in some kind of like a blanket or like a towel, some kind of fabric was wrapped in the body, and he had a huge blunt to the back of the head. Summer's body looked like it had gone through a massive beating, meaning that maybe Joseph was the first victim and that Summer was, you know, next. And she put up a fight because she had fractures all over her skull, on their jaw. And it just looked real brutal when they discovered her grave. And the boys, you know, they were bludgeoned to death as well. But
Summer had fractures to the front of her face, which means that she was facing her killer at the time.
Yeah.
And that to me is just like the most heartbreaking. Like if you think of that mama bear instinct and like.
Yeah. And even the pictures that they showed in the documentary series, like, her skull.
That part I would skip, guys.
Her skull was not even intact. It was in pieces. It was terrible. But, you know, they run through all these DNAs and, you know, DNAs that came back did not include Chase Merritt, but they had Joseph and Summer. And they had one other person's DNA on there that was not really necessarily relevant to the case, but Chase was so adamant about like, this is your suspect, this is your suspect. The whole entire time in trial, Chase is like, you got the wrong person. And it's like, all these things aren't really leading to clearing your innocence.
So going back to why the prosecution didn't run it, because I'm sure if I was listening, I would have a million questions.
Mm-hmm.
The reason they didn't run it is because there wasn't enough of a profile. You have to remember, these bodies were out there for 3 years and 9 months in all sorts of weathers. Yeah, it was a shallow grave, which means there was probably animals around snuffing and, you know, eating whatever remains were left. Like, through all those conditions, that DNA was probably unusable. And if you run something just for the sake of running it, what CODIS does is it tries to predict the rest of that. And all you're going to do is create so many more suspects that possibly have nothing. Like, there's not enough to go off of. And for you to fill in the blanks,
yeah,
you're making your job so much harder. Like, it's just not enough.
No, it wasn't. That was a good point, because I was not thinking about that at all. So that's a real good point. That's the exact reason why they actually didn't.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for clarifying it for all of us, Angie. But I feel like the biggest evidence.
Smoking gun, if you will, because there isn't one here.
Really is cell phone towers. Now, where the gravesite is, not too far in Victorville right there, there was a cell phone tower. And it happened to ping Chase Merritt's cell phone.
Can I just point out that it's the Mojave Desert? It's off the 15 freeway, but there is literally nothing out there. Like, it is straight open land and desert. Like, there is no store or shop or mall or, you know, business you could have been visiting or picking up an order or...
Put it this way. Imagine, I think a lot of us have seen The Hangover, where they meet Chow out in the middle of the desert where there's there's nothing. It's just a vehicle, and they flash the lights and they get the deal done. That's exactly what it looks like where they found the gravesite. And there's just there. Why would you be out there? There is no reason for anyone to be out there. It's insane. And to have Chase Merritt's phone ping off a cell phone tower, and it just happens to be right next to the gravesite.
On the same sector as the gravesite. It's like literally right in front of it.
You don't get very like, you know, it's how coincidental is that? But Chase has an excuse, or he has an alibi for it. He says that the reason why his phone pings off right there, it's on the wrong side. It's on the wrong side. My sister's house is on the opposite side of the tower.
I think you're missing the biggest part. His cell phone pinged on February 6th,
mm-hmm.
which was just 2 days after the murders.
Yeah.
And keep in mind, the day of the murders, his phone was completely off the grid. Which means to me that it probably slipped his mind. Like the first day he was like thinking like, okay, how do I cover my tracks? And I think the when he went back 2 days later, maybe to finish tidying stuff up or whatever the case was, he either didn't think much of it or was in such a rush that didn't consider that to even be an aspect.
Yeah. But also, too, what I find strange is that his sister, who lives in Victorville, who he says that it pinged off because he went to go visit her, when the police went to go investigate and get an interview for her.
In the early days, so early 2010. Yeah.
This is after the graves. They said that he hadn't even seen each other for over 5 years at that point in 2010.
I'm sorry. They went to interview her because San Bernardino took over at this point. So it was back in 2014.
Yeah, this is back in 2014. And Lieutenant Smith went to go interview the sister of Chase Merritt. And she's all like, I haven't seen him, you know, at that time. It has been like 5 years. And then she testified in court that, oh, yeah, like Chase did come up here on the 6th to come see me. But it's like there's recording of Lieutenant Smith interviewing the sister saying that
she hadn't seen him in years.
And it's like, that's very like, it's like, what do you believe?
So when she was on the stand, she also testified that she had been heavily medicated at the time due to being out of a surgery. And in the interview, you can hear that she's coherent. She's speaking fine, full sentences. There's nothing that gives you that impression that she wasn't feeling well. They also played phone calls again to his sister, reminding her of what she needs to remember to testify. So like, oh, remember that I went to see you and don't forget to say that, you know, I was with you all day.
Yeah.
So those don't help him at all, because if that was the case, you wouldn't need to remind someone of what they should remember, quote unquote.
No, it's very strange. And I think it's just like, he's just trying to manipulate, you know, things that were said before to make him look as the culprit.
They did have the detective come on to the stand and testify to impeach her testimony. So that one did get voided out because there was so many inconsistencies with what was on the recording versus what she actually testified to, which just sucks because nobody should have to go through that. Like, I would have rather said, like, you know, I'd rather not say anything than just make yourself that untrustworthy.
Yeah. But I mean, it's like,
she only made the case worse.
Yeah. Damned if you do, damned if you don't. Right. But it's like, oh, geez, all these things are not stacking up for him. And it's just, they're making him, you know.
And in the middle of this, guys, like cherry on top, one of his defense lawyers has like this grave medical issue where he ends up taking a month and a half off from the case. Keep in mind, it's a 6-month case. And for about 4 to 6 weeks, his lawyer was completely out. The other lawyer had to carry the entire rest of that trial or those 4 weeks by himself, unprepared. And it almost became like a public facade kind of thing, because this guy says that he had like some neurological issues and that's why he wasn't able to work. But then the prosecutors say that they went to a wedding for someone within their networks and that guy was seen there dancing and drinking and having a great time. But yet he was too sick to work. And it definitely came to question of like, is this a stall tactic? Are they trying to like give the pity card? You know, was this on purpose? Was he ever really sick?
Yeah, I think it's a lot of little tricks that they were trying to pull or whatever. I don't know what to believe.
Being under public eye is really hard for a case like this, because every little thing that any of these players do is being scrutinized. Like the deleting of the text messages, that prosecutor got put through the ringer. He almost got fired for it.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, you can't control something years later. Like, it wasn't done deliberately. He didn't get served and then he deleted them. Like, this was years later.
Yeah.
But there definitely was a microscope on every one of these lawyers.
Yeah. So, like, let's fast forward to, you know, closing arguments. You know, in the closing arguments, it was very dramatic where the prosecuting team was saying that, you know, the evidence that we presented to you shows that, hey, there is no, how coincidental is it that Chase's phone is on the gravesite? You know, where was he off the grid? And all this, like his DNA being in the family vehicle.
His truck in the camera.
Yeah. And there's this, like, there is no real smoking gun in this case. And it makes it so difficult to actually convict a person, but all this evidence does not help Chase at all. You know,
like, what are the odds that you're this unlucky? And that's actually a quote from the documentary. Like, this is either the unluckiest guy in the world or he's 100% guilty, because literally all arrows are pointing to him.
Yeah. So, you know, jury deliberates for a number of days, and they come back. They come back with the verdict, and they find Chase Merritt guilty of first-degree murder of Joseph McStay.
Life without parole.
Then they say that he's found guilty of second-degree murder of Summer McStay. He was found guilty of second-degree murder for Gianni and Joseph Jr. McStay, giving him the death penalty to be carried out in San Quentin prison. Now, someone that's on death row could eventually just die, but I don't know when's the last time that someone on death row in California has been actually killed.
Gavin Newsom put a hold to it. So until a new governor comes in and lifts that up, there are no more death penalty carryouts. There's sentencing, but they won't actually execute the death penalty at this moment.
Well, and, you know, in the courtroom, when they announced this, like the courtroom just kind of just like shocks, like, oh my gosh, like his Chase Merritt's family just, I forget who it is that runs out. I think it's the sister that she just like breaks down and runs out and is just like, oh my gosh. Like, and then Chase Merritt is like, just completely like numb. He just does have no reaction. And he, to this day, he's claiming his innocence. And it's so difficult because there is no real smoking gun, like how we said, but it's like, do you believe it? Even for me right now, I don't know if I believe it, that he is guilty. But who would have committed these crimes? David Kavanaugh? You know, Kavanaugh was in Hawaii when he was trying to get a hold of Joseph McStay. He's been cleared.
But there are threatening text messages from him to Joseph saying like, oh, if you screw me out of the business, like I'll screw with your livelihood. And then he claims that Joseph came around after being threatened and said, okay, you caught me, like I'll pay you out your half, because he was keeping all the profits. And it's just really hard for me to believe that side. Like, Dan Kavanaugh, I mean, taking money from somebody when they're missing and just, like, taking over their business. He sold the business a year later for $20,000 in cash, which is a really low amount for a business that was doing so well. I mean, there's a lot of shadiness to him. I don't know if he's capable of murder, but I definitely think that, like...
I don't think he's a good person because of the money that he took. And the deals that he made, but I don't think he murdered the family. You know, Michael, the brother, you know, Michael loved his nephews and his brother and the wife, like his sister-in-law. Like, I don't think he was capable. Yeah, like it was very strange and shady that he and his mom cleaned the house, but I can't see them being the ones that killed the family. Vic Johansson, Summer's ex-boyfriend, who, like, months before they were murdered, said, like, I love you, I miss you, and I want you back, was cleared. He had an alibi. He was in Orange County. And then McFadden had an alibi, too. So these people were cleared. So who else was there? Like, I mean, was there a mystery person? No. Like, I feel like Chase is the right guy, but they just don't have all the actual evidence that links into it. But
so there is one way to find out a definitive way, but neither the prosecutors nor the defense did this. The sledgehammer had ridges on it, which means that anybody that held it, their DNA would have gone into those little ridges as well, because it's a wood.
Yeah,
it's a wood handle.
Yeah, no, yeah, it was plastic. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And prosecution didn't test it because, like they said, they already had a lot of items to test. Like, they can only run so many items through CODIS, and that one just wasn't selected. The defense had an opportunity to request it, and they said that they didn't feel confident in the outcome, whatever that's supposed to mean, so they didn't run it either. And I don't know if at this point, if there is a retrial and if they ever do run it, if the answer would come back different or if it's been too long. But that's one thing that, like,
but even
probably
Chase,
would have answered all this.
Chase Merritt himself was like, run everything. Run the hammer. Like, that. If there is no evidence or no DNA of mine, that would clear my name. And they didn't, the defense didn't do it. Which kind of makes me lead to believe that the defense was getting paid to kind of mess this up a little bit too.
So they were doing this case pro bono, which means they do it for free. But the way they were going to get paid out is eventually if Chase went on to do like movie or book deals or whatever came from it, they would get a cut or a portion of those profits.
Yeah.
And that's how they would make their money later. Yeah.
Yeah.
So they were technically free, but they weren't free, which makes their motive to work for him a little weird.
And oh my gosh, like leading into all this now. So it's like, okay, so Chase has been, you know, there's been a sentencing and he tries to appeal the sentencing. And this is where it gets real like, oh my gosh, like real like Hollywood story, because Chase has two defendant lawyers. He has
defense attorneys.
Just defense attorneys. He has McGee and Malini. And Chase does not like McGee because McGee did not agree. They did not see the eye to eye with a cell phone tower and accuracies. And McGee was like, okay, you know what? I quit. So now Chase files for a new trial because of new information. McGee takes the stand for the misconception and misinformation of the cell phone tower. And during this whole, you know, retrial, Chase and his defendant attorney, Malini, they break away and they have a little meeting. And when they come back, the judge is like, what's new? And Malini tells him that Chase does not want to be defended by Malini anymore. And it's like a bombshell. Like, oh my gosh, are you kidding me? Like, now both of your defense of attorneys, you fired both of them. Like, that's insane. Oh my gosh. Like,
now I know the whole court, you can tell, was just like shock.
But get this. So the judge breaks off and goes in the back and they discuss with the courts. And when they come back, the request to fire Malini is denied. And then on top of that, the new evidence for a new trial, it does not hold. And Chase Merritt still is on death row. And this whole entire time, you know, Chase is like,
I think he really furious. Thought that he could control, like take control at this point. And like, okay, these defense attorneys didn't do what I wanted them to. I'm going to start from scratch. And it didn't pan out that way. And it kind of just shows how far he's willing to control the situation or attempt to.
Well, they call them what? A narcissist.
Yeah.
They call them a lot of times in the documentary.
Like he has a lot of traits of narcissism. Yeah, for sure.
And it's like, what? At the same time, you kind of have to feel for the person, Chase Merritt, because, you know, what if he is innocent?
That's a huge what if, but maybe. And actually, Chase's brother, Bennett Merritt, was convicted or accused of being the Hillside Strangler, which was a huge case in LA.
Yeah.
That we may cover later on. Who knows? Depends. But he was accused of being a murderer of like 7 young girls in the LA area. And he did jail time for a couple of years until it was proven that it was 2 other guys. But his family has a history of being convicted innocently, which definitely brings that question mark of, are they just a really unlucky family?
Ooh, yeah, that's true.
Like, it's all over the newspapers. In the 70s, it was a huge thing. Chase remembers, like, suffering through that time with his brother.
Yeah, that something like that gives a really bad light to the family name.
And how do you ever, like, rebuild your life after doing jail for something you didn't do and then having that, like, question mark and everybody in town knows that you were accused of it? Like, you can't really ever go back to having a normal life again because you're always seen by somebody as guilty.
Yeah, it's very strange. But let us know what you guys think. You know, is Chase Merritt guilty for the McStay family murders, or is he innocent, or is it someone else? Like, you let us know what you think. Please, you know, reach out to us on our social medias on Instagram, Where in the World is Crime _NSD, and on Facebook. So,
well, yeah. As of March of 2022, there's a couple more updates on Chase's thoughts. He says if he would have ever convicted murder, it would have been with Dan Kavanaugh, and that he feels that Dan is the one who's really 100% guilty for this murder, and that he somehow involved or orchestrated this and framed him. He says that once he gets out and once this is all over, he's going to make sure to get the prosecutors disbarred, and that his goal is to one day see his lawyers in jail for the injustice of how they represented him. So he sounds like he's still on a mission, one, to prove his innocence, and two, to like get revenge on people, which doesn't help make him look innocent at all.
No, I think it makes him look really psycho.
Yeah, if anything, it made me feel like he does have more of a violent streak. And one thing that I had to like remind myself through this is, if you look at photos of Chase Merritt now, he looks like a gentleman in his like mid-60s, I think.
Yeah.
But a decade ago, he was a very healthy, you know, welder, medium build, very strong, very healthy. Like,
well, there's that
physically that, he was capable.
There's that saying where, you know, it's that old man's strength. Old man's strength is stronger than gym strength, you know?
Never heard that.
You never heard that? You never heard that? Yeah, like, we're like, look at my dad. You see my dad. My dad is, like, petite, small, but, dude, this guy can freaking
still work. Oh, he's strong, yeah.
You know? He could still outdo me every day. Like, outwork me every single day. I was like, damn, dad. But, yeah. So, but here's to paying to our respects to the McStay family, and may they rest in peace. So now we've reached the end of our episode. And RSBS of the week,
Small Business Spotlight.
So let me introduce to you guys Studio Diner. Now, I love comfort food, and Studio Diner delivers that for me. It's, you know, it's amazing because this place has been around for a number of years. And the way that I found about this place was from Guy Fieri, Dive-Ins and Dives, the guy from Food Network, whatever his name is, the Guy Fieri.
That's, I know who you're talking about. I can't.
His show, I just can't, off the top of my head, I just messed it up. But that's how I found out about this place. And this is back when I was like still a teenager, and my mom took me down there, and it's like just comfort food, diner food, like nostalgia. What's really cool about this place is that it's built behind a studio lot, you know, where they've actually made films over there. And it's actually a really cool spot. Like, my favorite thing to go have when I'm there is the Count of Monte Cristo, which is a deep fried club sandwich. And they have like this raspberry jam, their waffle fries, their shakes. The last time I was there was right before COVID in 2019 for my birthday. And it's been kind of hard to go down there because they close early during the day.
We've gone a couple times and it's been a bust.
They used to be 24 hours, but now they're like from 7 to 2 or something like that. But please go check out Studio Diner, 4701 Ruffin Road, San Diego, California. Please go check out Studio Diner.
Make sure to tune in every Monday for your next dose of Where in the World is Crime in San Diego? Till then, catch us on the next case.
And in case we don't see you, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and good night.
Tell me, where in the world is
crime in San Diego?